You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.
Marie Littell was strangled to death at midnight. So the doctors concluded, after she was found the next morning in her parents' parlor. The doors had been locked, and there were no signs of forced entry, nor of a struggle. Whoever had killed her, police assumed, Marie had known, trusted, and let inside herself. There was only one suspect, Emile Gorbin, a bank clerk in Lyon and Marie's reputedly hot-headed boyfriend. Emile was the jealous type, witnesses told police, and Marie was a flirt. But when Emile was arrested, he presented an airtight alibi. He'd been partying and playing cards with a group of friends. They all vouched that he'd been with them until the stumbling drunks had finally passed out sometime around 1 in the morning. If Marie had been killed any time before 1910, in any place other than Lyon, France, that might have been the end of the case. Or else police might have found some random wino to pin the whole thing on and extracted a confession by force. One way or the other, we'd probably never have found out who really killed Marie Littell. But unluckily for Emile, Marie had been killed in Lyon in 1912, and that meant that Edmond Lacard was on the case. When Edmond Lacard was a 10-year-old boy in Lyon, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's A Study in Scarlet was published, introducing the world to its most famous fictional detective, Sherlock Holmes.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
For Lacard, the story and the dozens that followed were integrally formative. As unfathomable as it may seem, before A Study in Scarlet, the idea of a detective solving crimes using deductive reasoning and forensic science almost didn't exist. And what efforts there had been to use solid, dispassionate logic and hard evidence to figure out who'd done it had met with quite mixed results. Usually crimes were solved, such that they were, by superstition, hunches, and torture. After Sherlock Holmes, or even arguably because of Sherlock Holmes, things began to change. Among those leading the charge for change were two Frenchmen, Alphonse Bertillon and Alexandre Lacasson. Bertillon joined the Paris police as a copyist in 1879, where he was bowled over by piles of unorganized paperwork and the myriad methodless methods of the department's officers. Particularly, they had no system for cataloging those who had been arrested, or even convicted, of crimes before. Decades earlier, a career criminal named Eugene Francois Vidocq had turned over a new leaf and opened the Brigade de la Sarette, where he put his substantial criming experience to work trying to stop crime instead. One of his key observations, which he shared with the law enforcement community, was that many crimes were committed by career criminals and other reoffenders, such as he had been. He therefore advocated for the building of the world's first criminal database, which would catalog each arrestee's aliases, description, convictions, and whatever else the officer found relevant. Half a century later, that whatever the officer found relevant part was the problem Bertillon faced. The notes turned over from arresting officers to Bertillon for transcription were completely ad hoc. There was no way to file them or compare them or use them to do anything. So for years, Bertillon worked on a codified system for objectively gathering and sorting criminals based on measurable physical features. He identified 5 measurements: the length of the forearm, left foot, middle finger, the head, and then the circumference of the head, which, along with a photograph of the face, a mug shot, were used to identify and catalog convicts. Alexandre Lacasson was a physician, working at first for the French military at Val de Grâce Hospital in Paris. Later, he turned his focus to criminology and founded a school on the subject in Lyon. He helped try and commit serial killer Joseph Vauquer, known as the French Ripper, and managed to solve the most sensational French murder case of the 1880s, the Bloody Trunk case, in which he managed to identify the body of court bailiff Toussaint Augustin Goff weeks after, and hundreds of miles from, his murder, stuffed in a sack and carried in a suitcase from Paris to Lyon. Our boy, Edmond Lacard, managed to study with both Bertillon and Lacasson. In 1910, he convinced the Lyon Police Department to set him up with a new job and a new office, the world's first crime lab. But the cops refused to officially recognize his work there. Until 1912, when Marie Littell was murdered at midnight. Lacard performed an autopsy and concluded that Marie had been manually strangled to death. There were scratch marks on her neck where the assailant had choked her. So, Lacard took scrapings from underneath Emile Gourbin's fingernails. The scrapings included human skin cells. That, added to the locked room and history of jealousy, strengthened the case against the boyfriend. But all Lacard could say for sure about the skin cells is that they were human. Maybe Gourbin had scratched someone else, or maybe he'd scratched himself. The skin was suggestive of guilt, but not enough to displace Gourbin's perfect midnight alibi, a whole gaggle of drunken card-playing friends. But there was something else under his nails as well, a sort of pink dust. Under the microscope, he concluded it was a powder made up of rice starch, bismuth, magnesium stearate, zinc oxide, and iron oxide. In other words, makeup. Lacard ordered his investigators to go back to the Littell house and search Marie's room. There they found the same pink face powder. And remember, this is 1912, so there isn't much in the way of mass-produced, factory-made makeup. And soon Lacard was able to track the face powder back to a neighborhood chemist who testified that he made it specifically and solely for Marie Littell. Emile Gourbin was arrested. Lacard interrogated him not with torture, but with truth. He showed him the evidence of the makeup beneath his fingernails. And so, Emile Gourbin confessed. A few days before her death, he'd asked Marie to marry him, and she'd refused. So he made up his mind to kill her. The night of the strangling, he invited over a group of friends for drinks and cards. Before they arrived, he set the clock forward an hour, so that when they eventually passed out, he'd have that hour to go and kill Marie with the perfect alibi. Emile Gourbin was convicted of premeditated murder, and Edmond Lacard's crime lab and theories were vindicated. His main observation has been called Lacard's exchange principle, which criminologist and Manhattan Project contributor Paul Kirk described as follows. Wherever he steps, whatever he touches, whatever he leaves, even unconsciously, will serve as a silent witness against him. Not only his fingerprints or his footprints, but his hair, the fibers from his clothes, the glass he breaks, the tool mark he leaves, the paint he scratches, the blood or semen he deposits or collects. All of these, and more, bear mute witness against him. This is evidence that does not forget. It is not confused by the excitement of the moment. It is not absent because human witnesses are. It is factual evidence. Physical evidence cannot be wrong. It cannot perjure itself. It cannot be wholly absent. Only human failure to find it, study, and understand it can diminish its value. In other words, how do you know who committed a crime? By looking at the trace evidence exchanged between the culprit, the victim, and the crime scene. Since 1912, Lacard's exchange principle has been the bedrock of forensic science. But that makes you wonder, doesn't it? How did they establish guilt before Lacarde slapped the cuffs on Gorban in 1912? Before Lacasson identified Guff's body in 1889, before Arthur Conan Doyle gave the world Sherlock Holmes in 1887, or before Vidocq changed his criminal stripes in 1811. If the investigators, police, judges, and juries of yesteryear didn't have fingerprints and DNA and blood types and ballistics, what did they have? This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, How to Solve a Murder. We might as well begin with the most conspicuous of old-timey crimes, witchcraft. 1613, Bedfordshire, England. The son of Master Inger, the local land baron, fell ill and died. Not very suspicious when put into bullet point form, but Master Inger knew better. Not long before he took ill, the boy had been chucking rocks at an old hog tender called Mother Sutton. Mother Sutton was the grandmother of Henry Sutton, who sometime before had been caught throwing mud at local children in the mill dam. When one of Master Enger's servants discovered this, he boxed Henry's ears. Then Henry ran home and told his mother, Mary, and grandmother, Mother. Yes, that is confusing. A day later, a black pig had crossed in front of Enger's cart, causing the horses to spook and run off. Later, a different servant said he'd seen the sow walking into Mother Sutton's house. A little while later, the same servant who had beaten Henry was working in Enger's field when he was bitten by a beetle, which drove him into a speechless trance. Enger's son had heard his father blaming the Suttons for all this misfortune, which is how he got it in mind to whip some rocks at Mother Sutton and call her a witch. And then, sometime later, he fell sick and died. Well, that was just about enough for Master Enger. Mother Sutton had lived in Bedfordshire for nearly two decades raising pigs and had never been any trouble, but once Mary showed up to help her aging mother, things had begun to go downhill. Mother Sutton had fallen out with Master Enger well before the mudslinging, literal and figurative, or the cursed black sow, or the beetle bite, or the stone throwing, literal and figurative, or the tragic death of his son. But now that Enger looked back on it, he began to remember all the other things that had happened since he and Mother Sutton broke ties. Each and every cow and pig and horse that had died or been injured, or even acted somewhat bizarrely for a short length of time, was now recalled as further evidence of his theory. Mother and Mary Sutton were witches. But how to prove it? Well, you probably already know. So let's first go over the other stuff. Later on, a group of women would examine Mary's body and proclaim that she had an extra nipple, a witch's tit, on her thigh. After that, Henry Sutton, Mary's mud-throwing bastard child, would testify that he had heard his mother and grandmother plotting revenge against Enger and calling on their witches' familiars, named Dick and Jude, to kill his son. Probably Henry's testimony was coerced through torture. Perhaps Mary was tortured too, but more likely she confessed because of Henry's testimony. She wouldn't want to call her son a liar before God and country, after all. Or, you know, maybe she was a witch. And she might have thought that if she confessed, she'd be shown mercy. She was wrong on that, of course, and both her and her mother were hanged to death on March 30th, 1612. The ending out of the way, let's go back to the first proof, before Mary's confession or Henry's testimony or the itty-bitty extra titty committee. Even before the beetle-bitten servant told the court that a spectral Mary flew into his window in order to seduce him while sewing. After Enger's son died, he went to the Sutton house, had Mary beaten, tied, and then dragged to the mill, where Henry had set the whole thing off with his mud throwing. There, a rope was tied around her middle, and she was thrown into the river, in which she, damningly, floated. So, Mary and Mother Sutton became the first English women to be found guilty of witchcraft based on the trial of cold water. You know this one. Throw the accused into the water. If they float, they're a witch. If they sink, they're innocent. And also, drowned. Most of that is wrong, or at least misleading. For starters, the accused didn't drown, one way or the other, not unless something went wrong, at least. They were tied, as Mary was tied, to a rope so that they could be pulled out once a determination was made about their floating or sinking. That's important too. It wasn't always obvious whether a person had floated or sunk. In Mary's case, it was said that she initially sank, but then began to bob up. Then she was removed from the water. The testing having proved inconclusive, she was thrown in again, this time tied from her pinky finger to her big toe. Ropes were attached at either side of the river, with servants manning each of them and the bound Mary in the middle. The servants tossed the rope up and down like a jump rope, and this time it was agreed that she floated. Swimming witches, as the practice came to be called, turned out to be very popular, especially under King James in Scotland, throughout Poland, and in the American colonies. You might wonder, though, how Enger and his servants came up with the idea, and what the logic behind it was. The answer to the former question is that they didn't come up with it. Mary Sutton was the first English woman floated for witchcraft, but she was by no means the first person floated overall. Take the neighbors Aylward and Fulk. In 1174, Fulk detained Aylward after he found him breaking into his house. When the authorities arrived, Aylward explained that he had only done it to collect an overdue debt Fulk had accrued against him. To determine which was true, Aylward was hogtied and chucked into a pond, where he floated. The court was satisfied. Aylward was guilty, and so his eyes were gouged out and he was castrated. Ah, another day of justice delivered. The trial of cold water existed for at least 800 years before Enger thought to apply it to his alleged witches, but it was mostly used for people like Aylward, accused of less supernatural crimes like murder or theft or adultery. That might be surprising. I always figured that the premise of swimming witches was that there was something particular about witches which made them float, that the people believed their magic or the devil were protecting them from drowning. But that is almost 180 degrees wrong. When Enger dropped the beaten Mary Sutton into the river in 1612, he believed what most of Europe had believed for the better part of a millennium, that the water would embrace the innocent and reject the sinner. Mary floated not because the devil saved her, but because God, in the form of the river, spurned her, literally pushing her out of the water. There was nothing special about witches, so far as floating was concerned. Any old criminal would be buoyant by virtue of the justice of God. In this sense, swimming the accused was just one of a large set of medieval forensic techniques called ordeals. There's debate in etymological circles as to the derivation of the word ordeal. It comes from a conjunction in Old English, ordole, but ordole could mean impartial justice or ultimate justice. In either case, an ordeal, functionally, was a way to enjoin God into revealing his justice. The belief being that God would miraculously intervene to protect the innocent or punish the guilty. And medieval Europe was real creative about how it might trick God into showing his hand. For a long time, the ordeal of cold water was overshadowed by its sadistic cousin, the ordeal of hot water. As described by the Bishop of Bamberg in the late 1100s, a cauldron of water was brought to a boil and then a stone or iron ring thrown into it. Then the accused was to plunge their hand in and come up with the object. Then the hand would be wrapped and the defendant left for 3 days. At the end of that time, a priest would inspect the hand. If he determined the wound was healed or healing, then the person was innocent. Otherwise, they were burnt, literally and figuratively. The ordeal of hot iron used the same adjudication to determine the outcome, but instead of dunking a limb into boiling water, the accused had to walk 9 feet while carrying a pound of red-hot metal. Which is as natural a transition into the other most famous ordeal as we're bound to get.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Emma of Normandy became Queen of England when she married King Ethelred the Unready in 1002, then stopped being Queen of England when Sven Forkbeard of Denmark conquered it in 1013. Sven became the new King of England for a grand total of 5 weeks, whereupon he died. So Ethelred and Emma returned from exile and became king and queen once more. Then Ethelred died and Sven's son, Canute, became king, but, and I don't know how Emma felt about this, but here it is, but Canute married the widow Emma and she was able to remain queen. Emma had children with both Ethelred and Canute, which made things complicated after Canute's death. There was a short period of shared power between three different rulers, then Ethelred's younger son, Alfred, tried to take power, but he was betrayed, blinded, and killed. Long story, we'll get back to it. Then she supported the royal claim of Canute's son, Harthacnut, over her firstborn son of Ethelred, Edward the Confessor. But 2 years into Harthacnut's reign, he attended a wedding where, in the middle of a toast to the bride, he dropped dead, leaving Edward in charge. And it seems that Edward the Confessor felt spurned by his mother's favoritism for his half-brother, which probably didn't do her any favors when the allegations against her popped up a decade and change later. So the story goes, the Archbishop of Canterbury persuaded King Edward that the twice-widowed Queen Mother was conducting an illicit affair with the Bishop of Winchester, Alfwine. Edward had Elfwine and Emma remanded into custody, though hers was more like house arrest at a nunnery in Hampshire. From there, Emma wrote letters to other bishops where she fought the charges, but not for herself. Emma, either cunningly or saintedly, depending on what you believe, instead focused her protestations on poor Bishop Elfwine. Believe what you will about her, she wrote, but it is a sad thing that Elfwine's unimpeachable character should be dragged through such mud. Now, maybe Emma really was so selfless as to concern herself with the bishop's well-being over her own, anything's possible. You'd be forgiven, however, if you suspected this was a demure, roundabout way of defending herself. And it went deeper than face value. Aside from enduring an ordeal, another way a person accused of a crime might clear themselves was through compurgation. Under compurgation, a defendant could swear an oath of innocence. Then, if they could assemble a group of esteemed individuals, typically 11 or 12, to sign onto that oath, saying that they believed the claim, the person would be found innocent. By showing such fine and selfless character to the various bishops to whom she wrote, Emma appeared to be offering preemptive support to Elfwine's oath while practically lining up a bunch of powerful character witnesses of her own. If Emma hoped that her letters would spring her as easy as that, though, she was about to be disappointed. Instead, the bishops told King Edward that they should give her a chance to prove herself innocent by ordeal. A literal trial by fire. If Emma could walk across a set of 4 red-hot iron plowshares without injury, that would show God protected her for her innocence. The Archbishop, Robert, who had started this whole ball rolling, said, no way. If her innocence depended upon Elfwine's, as her letters suggested, then she should walk the fire for both of them. 4 plowshares for herself, and another 5 for the bishop. The next day, the setup was assembled, the assembly was set up, and 9 burning, hot slabs of iron were laid across the center walkway of the church. Then, Emma was brought in, and after a short prayer, she was led by hand, by bishops, on either side, blindfolded, over the near molten metal. As her feet reached the last step of the ordeal, she turned and asked the bishop on her right, "When shall we come to the plowshares?" She hadn't noticed a thing. King Edward the Confessor burst into tears, threw himself at Emma's unscorched feet, crying, "Mother, I have sinned before heaven and before you." He begged forgiveness from both her and Elfwine, restored their property and titles, and, for good measure, banished Robert, the scheming Archbishop of Canterbury, from the Isle of Britain. You may be searching for a logical explanation of how this miracle transpired, and there are plenty. The most obvious being, it probably didn't. There's no record of the ordeal of Queen Emma until 200 years after her death, which is never a good sign, and a lot of the details of the story are ahistorical at best. For instance, the early story says that the night before her firewalk, Emma prayed at the shrine of Saint Swithin, who appeared before her and promised, "Fear not, the fire shall do you no hurt." In her dowry, she had 9 manor houses, the same as the number of hot plowshares the saint had protected her over, and so she gave them, as an offering, to Saint Swithin. Except that an analysis of the 9 manors shows that not a one of them appears to have belonged to Emma, nor to have been passed to the church after the ordeal in 1050. Oh, but most suspiciously is that year, 1050, because Bishop Elfwine, whom Robert is said to have accused, Emma to have protected, and Edward to have apologized to, died in 1047. That's kind of a riddle, huh? But let's just pretend, for my own convenience, that Emma did walk uninjured over the trial by fire. Because even though she probably didn't, plenty of other less famous people did. So how might one, Emma or not, manage to successfully traverse the flames? I guess that might not seem like a question worth asking. Most people have seen someone walk over hot coals. Some of you listening might have even done it yourselves. It's a simple trick of physics. The coals may themselves be very hot, but they don't transfer heat very well. So as long as you're walking fairly briskly and maybe soak your feet in water beforehand, you should be able to get by. But iron isn't coal. Metal transfers heat extraordinarily well. And anyway, coal walking wouldn't explain those who were exonerated by other trials, like hot or cold water, or hot iron. What was really going on here? Well, let's look at another trial, the Ordeal of the Cross. In its early form, the Ordeal of the Cross demanded both the accused and the accuser to raise their arms outstretched in the shape of the crucifixion. Then, like they were vying for a Ford Mustang on a 70s Zoo Crew radio show, they would hold themselves in that position, and whoever's arms dropped first lost. That form of the Ordeal of the Cross was outlawed in 819 after concerns were raised that it might be inadvertently mocking Jesus. So, a new Ordeal of the Cross was conceived. In this version, a priest would take 2 sticks and carve a cross upon one of them. Then, both sticks would be wrapped in wool and laid upon the altar. The priest would then pray to God for his help determining the truth and pick one or the other of the wrapped sticks to open. If it had a cross on it, the accused was innocent. If it didn't, he wasn't. In this revised version of the cross ordeal, the power of the clergy or officials to put their thumbs upon the scales of divine justice are most obvious. All a priest needed was to know which stick was which through the cloth, a not very difficult thing to know, and then God's truth quickly became his. Most of the ordeals provided similar leverage points for those administering them. The trial of hot iron, for example, provided not only that a priest heat the iron, giving him say over how hot it should be, and then hold a prayer and consecrate the iron with holy water, giving him still more control over how much it cooled, but directly after the accused walked the distance with the hot iron, the priest bandaged up the hands so that no one could see them. 2 days later, it was the priest who would unwrap them, and he who would judge whether the wounds indicated guilt or innocence. The entire process, from start to finish, was totally under his sway. Hot water was the same way. Who heated the water? The priest. Who read the hands for their meaning? The priest. Even in the case of cold water trials, like where the Suttons were swam, the officiate had some measure of influence. Who could say whether a person was sinking or floating in a roaring river, manacled from toe to finger and suspended by rope on either bank? Why? Master Enger, or whomever was overseeing the ordeal and in command, which, up until 1215, was the priests. Perhaps the best indication that the whole thing was mostly a scam is that when priests and other powerful men were accused of wrongdoing, they usually underwent a different, much less taxing ordeal. For the best story of that ordeal, let's go back to the reign of King Canute, second husband of Emma. When Canute took over England, a lot of enemies of Ethelred the Unready, Emma's first husband, rose to political prominence. One of those was Godwin, who became Earl of Wessex in 1020. When Emma's son Alfred tried to take the throne and reclaim London, it was Earl Godwin of Wessex who pledged to help him. Instead, he and his men descended upon Alfred's, killing nearly all of them, before binding Alfred and putting him on a boat to be held captive at the monastery of Ely. But somebody, I'm looking at you, Earl Godwin of Wessex, decided to put out his eyes before he delivered him to the monks. They looked after the newly blinded prince for a few days, but he soon died from infection. A pretty good mutiny, all told. Nice sedition, well done. Except, as we know, King Harthacnut died after a brief reign, and then Edward the Confessor ascended. Edward was Alfred's older brother, so that's awkward. Edward and Godwin had a couple of scuffles, but eventually made something like peace for a while. But Edward never ceased in his belief that Godwin had betrayed and murdered his brother. Now, this part, the important part, is almost as surely legend as Emma's ordeal. But 2 centuries after they were all dead and buried, Aelred of Ravaux wrote that Godwin made an effort to prove his innocence at a royal dinner on April 15th, 1053. He chose the same ordeal that priests did when they wanted to get off the hook, the corsned. It had a lot of other names, the trial of the accursed morsel, ordeal by host, ordeal by sacrament, but most plainly, trial by bread. When a cleric underwent the trial, he would stand before the altar with the host, the wafer, sanctified for Holy Communion, and pray for God to stop his throat from accepting the body of Christ if he were guilty. Then, he would put it in his mouth, chew, and swallow. Ta-da! God says I didn't do it! There were problems with offering communion to a potential criminal in a state of mortal sin, so some elaborate prayers were cooked up full of legalese loopholes to ensure that it was only really communion if the subject were innocent. Otherwise, there'd be no transubstantiation, and yeah, it must have felt like a stretch, because soon, priests were less willing to participate in the trial of the host. Instead, they worked up an alternative, corsned, which was a bit of barley bread, sometimes with cheese, upon which the Lord's Prayer was written and a few holy conjurings made. The corsned, then, was like a host that only caught liars and criminals. All the costs, none of the benefits. The methadone of communion wafers. Although, like I said, sometimes it came with cheese, which I think we can all call an improvement. So, at dinner, at Winchester, on April 15th, 1053, Earl Godwin of Wessex swore upon a corsned that he had nothing to do with the death of King Edward's brother, Alfred. He then took the bread, put it in his mouth, chewed, and choked to death. Right there. No way, you yell? Good eye. Like I say, this is based on an account from Aelred of Ravaux, from more than 100 years after. The contemporary, less flamboyant account of Godwin's death comes from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which describes Godwin as suffering a sudden stroke while at dinner with the king and being carted off to his room where he lived on in a weakened state for a few days and finally died. But where's the fun in that? With the possible but unlikely exception of Godwin, the trial by host was meant to be a cakewalk. A cheesecake walk, even. But maybe all of the ordeals were. Records, incomplete as they are, suggest that something like 2/3 of those who underwent ordeals came out innocent. While we tend to have a Kafkaesque vision of trial by cold water as a damned if you do, damned if you don't torture, it's probably more accurate to say that the ordeals were meant to lean towards mercy and exculpation, not punishment. There's a lot of scholarly debate around ordeals today, and one of the main questions is precisely that. Were the ordeals built to condemn or forgive? The trial of hot iron and the trial of hot water were both definitely painful and possibly marked those who underwent them with burns for life. But maybe that was the point. Maybe those trials were really used as a sort of pre-punishment, a way to dole out a little suffering along with a chance at redemption. If the priest attending to a hot water trial thought the lesson was learned, he'd say the accused had passed. One of the other hotly debated topics around ordeals is whether and to what degree they might have worked. And, well, let's save that for later. The third major question among modern scholars is why ordeals stopped. In one sense, they obviously didn't. The swimming of witches went on into the 18th century, and sporadic ordeals for other crimes pop up into the 15th and even 16th centuries. In the last 15 years, there's been a political movement to crack down on ordeals still being practiced in rural Liberia. But the European practice of ordeals began to peter out in the 13th century, particularly starting after the Fourth Council of the Lateran in 1215. It was there and then that Pope Innocent III forbade the practice, putting an end to Catholic priests participating in ordeals, at least officially. And without a priest officially there to bless, deliver rites, and otherwise oversee the process, its power quickly dwindled. As to why the ordeals were forbidden, there are four popular theories. The first is that the ban was just one part of a much larger stratification in the church. The Fourth Council also forbade priests from acting as barbers and surgeons, barred them from swearing oaths to private citizens, and otherwise did its best to separate the spiritual from the physical. Perhaps the church thought that handling matters of court was like those other earthly things, an unbecoming of the priesthood. But the other three commonly cited factors must have played at least some part in the ending of ordeals, given that they were definitely a part of the public discourse at the time. And all three of them are best expressed by Peter Cantor. Peter was the cantor, or chanter, at Notre Dame in the late 1100s, and his writings and teachings deeply influenced the Fourth Lateran Council, even though by that time he'd been dead for nearly 20 years. Cantor is sometimes credited with inventing the Catholic idea of purgatory, or at least giving it its name, and of helping codify the sacrament of penance. But he also had a lot to say about ordeals. Virtually none of it good. His first two points against ordeals were theological. He argued that God had no cause to be consistent in his interventions. Yes, of course God has the power to intercede on behalf of the innocent, but he cannot be compelled to by priestly incantation. God doesn't answer to clergy, not even to the Pope. So sure, a finding of innocence might be divine justice, but a finding of guilt could never be guaranteed. Maybe he sometimes allowed a person to be burnt not because of their wrongdoing, but because of some unknown and unknowable part of his ineffable plan. And anyway, asking God to interfere on behalf of the innocent was itself a sin, said Peter. In the Gospel of Matthew, Book 4, Chapter 5, the devil tries to tempt Jesus. He takes him to the highest point of the Temple of Jerusalem and goads him to jump off.
If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone. Jesus said unto him, It is written again, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God.
Trying to force God into protecting the innocent from an ordeal was testing him, Peter argued, and that was not to be done. Peter Cantor's third argument wasn't theological, it was practical. See, at the time, there was no way for a convict to appeal their conviction other than to accuse the judge, usually a priest, of wrongdoing. Since ordeals delivered the justice of God, the only way a verdict could possibly be incorrect was if the person overseeing it was corrupt. But challenging the honesty and integrity of the clergy was not a good idea, if you'd believe it, so for all intents and purposes, the first judgment was final. In his role as cantor at Notre Dame, Peter had cause to see many ordeal trials, and he noticed something about the omniscient justice of God. It was frequently wrong. Peter wrote about one man whose story he had witnessed. He was a pilgrim who went off with another man, but returned alone. Suspicions began to percolate around the community that he had killed the man somewhere on the road. The accused, eager to prove his innocence, agreed to undergo the trial of cold water. But unfortunately for him, he floated, was proclaimed guilty, and put to death. Not long after his hanging, his victim wandered back into town, fully unaware of his own murder. Whichever the reason or combination of reasons, Pope Innocent III prohibited priests from ruling on criminal or civil matters and from overseeing ordeals, which left most of Europe temporarily without a way to adjudicate either criminal or civil disputes. Sometimes, back in the ordeal days, they would convene a group of people, a jury of presentment, to determine whether or not an ordeal was necessary. And a couple years later, it occurred to somebody that maybe they could make another one of those, less grand but more jury-ish, to take the place of the boiling water or hot coals or such. And so we got grand juries and jury trials. It was a step in the right direction, but there were a couple of holdovers, old customs related to the ordeals, but not closely enough to be prohibited by the new church law. And so they lived on much longer. The Constant is brought to you by BetterHelp. What interferes with your happiness? Is something preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp assesses your needs and matches you with your own licensed professional therapist, allowing you to start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line or self-help. It's professional counseling in a safe, private, convenient online environment. Send a message to your counselor anytime and receive timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp has licensed professional counselors specializing in depression, trauma, relationships, grief, and much more. And since it's available worldwide, you can find the particular expertise you need online without limiting yourself to the counselors located near you. Anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is convenient, professional, and affordable. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/theconstant. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/theconstant.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
On the morning of May 27th, 1817, a Warwickshire man in the Midlands of England spotted a bloody shoe on the road on his way to work. He called out, summoned a few others, and together they raked the surrounding area and discovered the body of 20-year-old Mary Ashford in a nearby marshy pit. The autopsy and examination of the scene together painted a savage scene, that Mary and a man in nailed shoes had run from the road into the wood, that she had fallen, her legs pulled apart, the man on top of her, that she had been penetrated, bloodied, then dragged, bleeding, to the pit and drowned. Mary Ashford was a slight and beautiful young woman from a good but poor home. She worked as a housekeeper to her uncle and, on the night of her death, left to attend a dance at the local pub, Tyburn House, with her close friend Hannah Cox. There she had caught the eye of 24-year-old Abraham Thornton. He was the son of a bricklayer who assisted his father still, and suspicion fell on him immediately. He'd been seen at the pub with Mary for most of the night and had convinced her to leave with him around 11. The two took off along with Hannah Cox. Mary was meant to stay along with Hannah in Erdington, but made an excuse to ditch her and head off alone with Thornton. The circumstantial case against Thornton was strong. He'd been seen with Mary alone several times the night of her death. Two of his friends testified that when he first saw her at the pub, he had declared, "I have been intimate with her sister and will with her or die by it." When Thornton was arrested and examined himself, it was found that his shoes were similar to those that left the prints at the murder scene, and that his undergarments were pocked with blood. However, it was no slam dunk. For the bloodstains, Thornton freely offered that he had been intimate with Mary Ashford the night before and had taken her virtue, but with her consent, and left her alive and well. This gelled with the testimonies of several more people who had seen Mary alone after the last sighting of her with Thornton. At around 2:45 in the morning, a man familiar with Thornton had seen him coming out of a house with a young woman who was probably Mary Ashford, but after that, somewhere between 4 and 5, Mary had returned to Erdington and awoken Hannah Cox. She was looking for her work clothes so that she could get back to her uncle's before he rose. Not long after changing clothes, she was spotted by one of the other Tyburn House partiers, who was finally on his way home. He testified that she was walking quickly back towards her uncle's house along the road where the worker would find her bloody shoe an hour or so later. And several more witnesses claimed to have seen Thornton walking home to Bromwich after that, making the window of time available for him to have committed the murder almost impossible to pin down. The murder of Mary Ashford is a pretty good illustration of the no man's land that criminal inquiries existed in between the time Pope Innocent III barred ordeals and the time Edmund Lacard's crime lab found Marie Littell's makeup. It made sense that Abraham Thornton was responsible for Mary's death, and there were no obvious other suspects, yet the authorities in 1817 had no good method of proving it. Way back in the late 12th century, Peter Cantor had argued that ordeals were insufficient for determining guilt, as proof of guilt should be, quote, as clear as daylight. But without either an eyewitness or a confession, what evidence could the 19th century count on to meet that burden? With one big weird exception that we'll get back to in a few minutes, there wasn't much way to prove who committed a crime like Mary Ashford's murder. The court of public opinion was quite sure that Thornton had done the deed and produced a torrent of pamphlets and handbills calling for his head, but in actual court, the matter was far from settled. After only a day, because what more was there to say that couldn't be said in a day, both prosecution and defense rested and turned the case over to the jury. The jury seemed a little confused about what to do, so the judge reminded them of the old axiom that it was better to let a murderer go free than wrongly convict an innocent man. That clinched it. Without even retiring to deliberate, the jury found Abraham Thornton not guilty right there from the box. End of story? Not by a long shot. Thornton's acquittal was met with outrage among the people of Warwickshire, and soon a letter-writing campaign took hold around the county papers. The angry masses had an object in mind. Because Thornton had already been acquitted by the state, he couldn't be tried again. Not the regular way, at least. See, there was an old law on the English books. It said that the victim of a crime, or their family, had the right to hire a private barrister and do the whole thing over. Essentially, they could sue for murder, but in criminal court. In the 1700s, most prosecutions were overseen by private attorneys because there wasn't much in the way of a public justice system. The attorney and solicitor general's offices mostly oversaw matters in which the state was either victim or accused. The people behind the letter-writing campaign solicited donations from the public, and once the fee was collected, Mary's brother, William Ashford, brought the charge against Abraham Thornton once more. It was rare for someone to invoke the right to privately retry an accused murderer in 1817, but even rarer was what Thornton did. On the 1st of October, William filed the writ of appeal, and Thornton was rearrested. He was brought before the King's Bench, and on November 17th, he was asked how he pleaded, and replied, "Not guilty, and I am ready to defend the same with my body." He turned around to his lawyer, who handed him a pair of gloves. He put one of them on, and threw the other to the ground, in front of William Ashford. Appeal of murder by private solicitor was an old legal concept, but Abraham Thornton was answering it with a much older one. Trial by combat. In England, as well as Germany, Sweden, and several other Germanic nations, trial by combat had been a legal remedy since at least 700 AD. The logic was essentially the same as trial by ordeal, that God would take the side of the righteous claimant and deliver to them a victory. But, unlike other ordeals, you didn't need a priest to adjudicate the outcome. The church didn't need to be involved at all. So, while most of the other ordeals began to wither on the vine after 1215, trial by combat lived on. There were rules, of course. A lot of rules, actually. You couldn't invoke trial by combat if there was a confession, or witnesses, or a preponderance of evidence against you. And you couldn't fight your way out of a murder charge. Unless it was brought privately as an appeal. But nobody actually participated in trial by combat by the time Thornton's glove fell before the feet of William Ashford. The last time it had happened in England, a servant had prevailed against his drunken master who accused him of treason. That was in 1446. But even though it had been nearly 400 years since English courts had overseen a trial by combat, they had never actually removed it as a legal option. The terms of the combat were set firm. The two were to meet in a 60-foot square jousting list. The matter was settled when either accused or accuser were dead, or surrendered by saying the old English word for "I am defeated," which eventually became synonymous with cowardice, craven. If the defendant, Abraham Thornton, said craven, he would be hung there on the spot. If William Ashford did, he would be charged with outlawry, beyond legal protection. Anyone would be free to steal from, beat, abuse, or even murder him with impunity. Needless to say, this was not how Ashford had expected things to go. His lawyer objected on the grounds that Thornton ought not be allowed to free himself from the murder of Mary by also murdering his brother, but the Chief Justice repudiated him. It is the law of England. We must not call it murder. The trial was adjourned to give each side time to file motions. Ashford's side argued that combat would not be fair to him, since William was spindly and unathletic, while Thornton was a humongous mountain of a man, reputedly one of the strongest people in England. Thornton's side, in contrast, argued that a trial by jury would not be fair to him, given all of the slanders being peddled about him in the press. So, Ashford argued that the case against Thornton was too strong to allow for trial by combat, which fell apart pretty quickly, given that the whole reason they were in this mess to begin with was because Thornton had already been acquitted once. This point and counterpoint went on until April 16th, 1818, when the court finally delivered its decision. There were no legal grounds on which to deny Thornton his right to trial by combat. Under these circumstances, however obnoxious I am myself to the trial by battle, it is the mode of trial which we, in our judicial character, are bound to award. We are delivering the law as it is, and not as we wish it to be, and therefore we must pronounce our judgment that the battle must take place. Then, court was adjourned again to give Ashford 4 days to think about what he wanted to do, drop the charges, or fight. On the 20th, he decided to fight. For the release of Abraham Thornton! Let him go, said the prosecution, and so Thornton was freed. It wasn't a perfect ending for him, though. The people were so out for blood that he had to flee the court through a side exit, and after months of constant harassment and hatred, he emigrated to the United States. The next year, Parliament officially abolished both private appeals and trials by combat. That left only one ancient mode of justice standing, and one last story for us to tell.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode where I'd like to tell you a story.
At the same time that William Ashford was weighing whether or not to pick up the glove against Abraham Thornton, another curious murder mystery was taking place in Sharonville, Ohio, outside of Cincinnati. The victim was a man, Louis Sartain, a farmer, who went missing one morning. His brother, Crawford, went out looking and discovered Louis's cold body, alone in the woods. He'd been shot in the head. Louis Sartain was a good man, with a good family, good friends, and no enemies to speak of. In fact, nearly everyone in Sharonville was known for their friendliness and honesty. Except for Creel Williams. Creel was a hard-drinking, hard-cussing, bitter, irascible mountain man who, as it happened, lived and hunted in the woods not far from where Crawford found his brother's remains. Crawford and friends quickly came to believe that this was no coincidence. Crawford and some of Lewis's friends began investigating. They found footprints near the murder scene, which they thought might belong to Creel. The town doctor dug the slug out of Lewis's head, and they all said it looked like the kind of bullet Creel Williams used. In the meantime, Creel Williams went about his normal life, even discussing the murder with others around town, shaking his head in somber disbelief that someone could have done such a thing. Like everyone else in Sharonville, Creel Williams had liked Louis Sartain. So why would he have killed him? When Creel got word of the rumors going round that people, including Lewis's brother, suspected him, he bellowed that question loud and publicly. Why would I want Louis Sartain dead? No one had an answer. Unless he didn't want Louis Sartain dead. Unless he wanted someone else who looked like Louis Sartain dead. Like Claiborne Williams, Creel's brother. Not long before the murder, Claiborne had come by Creel's homestead and run off with one of his brother's horses. Creel was mighty sore about it and not shy about expressing that, either. Maybe, in the morning mist, out rabbit hunting, Creel had mistaken Louis Sartain for his own brother and fired upon him out of misplaced spite. It made sense to Crawford Sartain, and the more they thought about it, the more it made sense to the other people of Sharonville, too. Why, sure, it must have been Creel Williams. The only thing missing was the proof. The people of Sharonville, Ohio, in 1818, didn't know about fingerprints, or DNA, or ballistics, or blood spatter analysis. They didn't throw accused criminals into cold water, either, or walk them across hot coals, or give them barley bread with cheese, or hot iron, or make them hold their arms out like they were Jesus for as long as they could. They didn't even have rules about defendants dueling their accusers. What they did have was one of the oldest, most persistent, and long-lived beliefs about murderers and their victims. Cruentation. The belief in cruentation goes back at least as far as 6th century Germany, where the epic poem Nibelungenlied was first composed. In it, the heroic dragon slayer Siegfried is stabbed in the back by Hagen as he drinks from a stream. Then, Hagen arranges to have Siegfried's body thrown outside his widow Gudrun's door. The perfect crime. No witnesses, no evidence. But at the funeral, something happens. When Hagen approaches Siegfried's lifeless body, blood begins to flow out from it, through the stab wounds Hagen made. Gudrun realizes that this is the testimony of her beloved husband, coming from beyond the grave. Hagen is the killer, and the blood has given him up. Probably this belief that a body bleeds in the presence of its killer was already well known, but it only became more so with time. Before King James I of England had the first English language Bibles printed, he was King James VI of Scotland, where his legacy pertains to the thousands of people, mostly women, he had executed for witchcraft, vampirism, lycanthropy, and other very real things. In 1599, he published Daemonology, a kind of royal dissertation of sorts on magic, necromancy, and, in a brief digression, the solving of crime. Writes James, "In a secret murder, if the dead carcass be at any time thereafter handled by the murderer, it will gush out of blood, as if the blood were crying out to the heaven for revenge of the murderer, God having appointed that secret supernatural sign." It's believed that William Shakespeare read Daemonology and took from it the witch's rhymes in Macbeth, cursing the Scottish play through all time to such a degree that many actors refused to say its proper name, Macbeth. 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 But Shakespeare wouldn't have needed Daemonology to know about cruentation, otherwise known as the ordeal of the bleeding corpse, or, I think most ominously of all, the beer rite. Because the idea was spread far and wide, way beyond even the far-reaching grasp of King James. In Act 1, Scene 2 of Richard III, Lady Anne enters King Henry's funeral in an absolute unrivaled tizzy with some very strong words for his murderer, whoever that might be.
Cursed be the hand that made these fatal holes. Cursed be the heart that had the heart to do it. Cursed the blood that let this blood from hence. A more direful hap betide that hated wretch that makes us wretched by the death of thee than I can wish to adders, spiders, toads, and any creeping venomed thing that lives. If ever he have child, abortive be it. Prodigious and untimely brought to light, whose ugly and unnatural aspect may fright the hopeful mother at the view.
That murderer, with the adders and spiders and toads and abortive child brought untimely to light and etc., is soon revealed to be none other than Gloucester, Richard III himself. Anne works it out right there on the spot.
Oh, gentlemen, see, see! Dead Henry's wounds open their gonialed mouths and bleed afresh. Blush, blush, thou lump of foul deformity, for 'tis thy presence that exhales this blood from cold and empty veins where no blood dwells. Thy deed, inhuman and unnatural, provokes this deluge most unnatural. Oh, God, which this blood madest, revenge his death. Oh, earth, which this blood drinkest, revenge his death. Either heaven with lightning strike the murderer dead, or earth gape open wide and eat him quick, as thou dost swallow up this good king's blood, which his hell-governed arm hath butchered.
Very little chill on Lady Anne.
Vouchsafe, diffused infection of a man.
Okay, Lady Anne, that's enough, thank you. You've been great. I hope everything works out for you. Cruentation, or the beer rite, was seen as the most reliable way to ferret out a murderer from the early medieval period in most of northern and western Europe. It was officially sanctioned by King James, after all, and defended as the best possible method of examination by Michael Alberti, professor of natural science and medicine at Berlin University, and author of System of Forensic Medicine, the go-to book on criminal investigation throughout the 17th and early 18th centuries. The practice didn't fare well through the Enlightenment, with its emphases on empiricism generally and anatomy specifically, but even though cruentation had fallen exceedingly out of favor by the 1800s, there was still that same catch we've already run across. If not this, then what? The people of Sharonville believed strongly that Creel Williams had killed Louis Sartain. But strong belief is a yawning chasm away from proof, and they had no bridge to cross it, other than that rickety old rope swing known as the beer rite. A public meeting was held at the Baptist Church at the edge of town. Constable John Shepherd was the first to openly suggest they exhume Sartain's body, but judging by the response, he wasn't the first to think it. Fig Latham and Case Woods sprung up and argued for it immediately after Shepherd's suggestion. Louis Sartain should be dug up and put on display for every man in Sharonville to visit and lay hands upon. It would be a fair trial, giving equal opportunity to all, but aimed squarely at Creel Williams. Crawford Sartain, itching for vengeance, gave the say-so. All right, let's go ahead and do it. It was mid-July, the height of heat, a simmering, sunny Wednesday afternoon, when the corpse of Louis Sartain, buried more than a month, was pulled from the wormed earth and placed at the altar of the church. His skin had begun to shrivel. It shimmered and writhed at every orifice and abrasion with wriggling white worms. When the villagers attempted to file in, they were punched square in the face by the thick stench of human rot. The first name to be called was Samuel Corwin, who held his breath, approached the corpse, and laid his hand upon it. Nothing. Next was Cornelius Howard, who did likewise, and with the same result. So they all came, every last man of Sharonville, to greet the grisly scene and pat the creeping flesh. Not a drop of blood was to be found. Finally, and lastly, Constable Shepherd called for Creel Williams, who was waiting outside the church door, along with most everyone else. No one could stand to be inside with Sartain's body and its ungodly reek, but when Williams entered, the whole town followed. This was the moment they'd been waiting for. Creel Williams approached Louis Sartain, knowing full well that this entire spectacle had been designed to ensnare him. He was pale, but not sickly. He walked quickly, but not overly so. He took a moment of respectable silence at the coffin, but not too long of one. And then he lay his hand upon Louis Sartain. It is impossible to know whether Creel Williams was indeed the killer. If he wasn't, he would have had little to fear. And if he were, he must have convinced himself that this morbid ritual was pure superstition. Either way, we can imagine that he must have expected the corpse not to bleed, and yet he must have feared, on some level, that it would. That fear was unfounded. As it had for the 300 touches that preceded Creel's, Louis Sartain's blood remained still and silent. Williams turned and walked out of the church without a word, quickly, but not overly so. The people of Sharonville agreed that the test had been a bust. Louis Sartain's body had been too long in the grave to do its duty. But there was no further recourse. Creel Williams was acquitted and at liberty to live a long, free life. Except that a few weeks later, he got into a drunken row with a fellow roustabout named Joe Mounts, who hit him over the head with a wooden roller. Dr. Allison was called in to treat his crushed skull and went about doing so by boring a half-inch diameter hole into his brain. Perhaps this was the justice of God, the same spirit that had animated all the ordeals and combats and beer rites through the ages. Or it was just one more random bit of suffering visited stochastically upon any person, good, bad, or otherwise, who had the mixed misfortune to live in such a strange and uncharitable existence. Same difference. One thing's for sure. We should all thank our lucky stars to live in the wake of Edmund Lacard, his crime lab, and his exchange principle. We're lucky that today's forensics are based on solid, peer-reviewed, falsifiable, and dispassionate science, rather than prejudice and superstition. No, I'm kidding. It's all a fraud. I'll see you in 2 weeks for part two. Music for today's episode by Blue Dot Sessions, Lee Rosevere, Kevin McLeod, Ensemble Morales, Thurston Dart, Papillon, and the United States Marine Band. Special thanks go out to our patrons who make this show possible, especially William Meadows, JP, Jahan Kazir, Barbara Hedrick, Kamajit Gill, and Ashley Milner. If you want to join them, go to patreon.com/theconstant to sign up, or visit our website, constantpodcast.com. From there, you can find not only that Patreon site, but all of our old episodes, our social media presences, and our merch store, where you can finally find that t-shirt of Aristotle being ridden around naked like a pony you've always been looking for. We're a proud part of Hub and Spoke Audio Collective, home to Ministry of Ideas, whose recent two-part episode, Dissecting Morality, I ate up in one sitting because it is 100% my jam, and probably yours too, if you like listening to me. Go check it out. Until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, where fingerprint analysis first came to the United States when... Oh, well, we'd better save that for part two. This has been The Constant. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. I do not know how this intro is going to go yet. So this is a placeholder. It'll probably be around this length.